these are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
And I think it'd be interesting just to really try to unravel what his ties.
There's a sort of country-city divide.
They're inconvenient. Ends and it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today we'll hear a heart-to-heart talk, mother to daughter, about working for Playboy magazine, all back in its heyday under the late Hugh Hefner.
You know, and Hef had his finger on the pulse. The world was ready for a change. Otherwise, it wouldn't have followed him off a cliff. Right?
And I'm going to spend some time with a musician who was absolutely exciting to me, someone who began in rock music and veered into the avant-garde, Annie Clark, also known as St. Vincent, coming up later.
Entombed in the shrine of zeros and ones, you know, you know. Oh, with fatherless speeches, you motherless creatures.
That's all coming up later. But we begin the hour with football, and this season, the player on everybody's mind hasn't set foot on the field even once. Colin Kaepernick, formerly of the 49ers, is an unsigned free agent. But the silent protest against police brutality that he began last year, taking a knee during the national anthem, now has a life of its own. We can thank the President of the United States, of course, for reigniting a protest that was not very popular in the first place and had kind of lost its momentum after Kaepernick left the 49ers.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now, out, he's fired. He's fired!
The New Yorker's Jelani Cobb recently sat down with Bill Roden, late of the New York Times, now a contributor to ESPN's website, The Undefeated. Roden is also the author of the book, $40 Million Slaves, about black athletes in professional sports.
The first time we met was at a restaurant in Harlem, and you had a group of people there. Roman Oben from the Giants was there. Yeah, right. Yeah.
This is the little restaurant on.
It was on Eighth Avenue.
Okay. Oh wow, man.
So we had this interesting conversation then, though, about the ways in which the American anxieties, if we could call it that, around race are so consistently refracted through sports. Mm. And I wondered if we could just start by talking about why do we always seem to find sports being the arena in which American attitudes, especially around race, become front and center.
Yeah, and I've thought about that, obviously, for decades. Mm-hmm. And two things. I've kind of changed my nomenclature. Because mm-hmm. our problem, we talk about race, and our problem in the United States is not race. Mm-hmm. It's racism. That's the problem.
Right.
And it's no longer a intersection. Mm-hmm. So that intersection is now a collision. Mm-hmm. And I think that, and I was, you know, so the president is in Huntsville, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
Huntsville, Alabama in football season.
Mm-hmm.
Saturday afternoon, half of them are going to be at Auburn, mm-hmm. you know, front mm-hmm. and center. The other half is going to be at Tuscaloosa and mm-hmm. Alabama mm-hmm. cheering. Mm-hmm. Two teams, by the way, that when you look at the primary players, the starting teams, you could be looking at Howard and Alcorn.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
two historically black colleges. Yeah.
All these young black men mm-hmm. who are the object of mass incarceration, police violence. This is a demographic.
Mm-hmm.
Black folks are in your face, front and center. For a lot of people, this is the only time they really get to see a lot of young, virile black people in positions of they is positive and controlled.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening now is that this young generation, now these guys are saying, wait a minute, you know, you got to make a choice because mm-hmm. I now am a feeling wealthy black man. And I'm just not going to go out and play ball.
But there's a question, though, I think that I guess warrants some discussion, which is that we've had a great deal of conversation about kneeling during the national anthem. We've had a lot less conversation about the issue that led Colin Kaepernick to kneel in the first place. As you watched this unfold, did it seem like something got lost in translation? Because we were not really talking about police violence. We were talking about the national anthem.
Not only law, hijacked.
Mm-hmm.
It was hijacked. Mm-hmm. You know, they hijacked the message. And to me, the height of when I knew that the thing had totally been hijacked was, I guess, when the Dallas Cowboys and Jerry Jones Jerry Jones had all his players, and they knelt before the national anthem. Then I said, well, that defeats the whole purpose.
Right.
Imagine if Tommy Smith and John Carlos would have, you know, raised their fist in the tunnel, or Dr. King would have given his, you know, "I Have a Dream" speech
in
like
in the hotel
in a, before in a barbecue somewhere. Right. The whole point of doing these things is to make people uncomfortable.
But it also has a kind of echo of history because this year marks the 50th anniversary of the Cleveland Summit. Mm-hmm. And I know you've written about this, and I wonder if you could just talk about what exactly the Cleveland Summit was and why it was significant.
So the Cleveland Summit came about, I think it was 1967. You said 50, right? I was mm-hmm. English major, so it was 67. So
you should have a segment, English majors do math.
Do
minor math problems.
So, you know, math, English, you know. But, you know, so Jim Brown called the meeting. This was 1967. And Jim Brown, who had just retired from the NFL, kind of stunning everybody, because he was like at that point maybe the greatest running back ever, and he just walked away from the game, you know. But there were all these things that were going on in 67. Ali, major mm-hmm. among them was Muhammad Ali, said that he wasn't going to the draft. And so Jim Brown called a meeting of some of the top athletes, black athletes in the country. Lou Alcindor, who had later changed his name. I think he was maybe a sophomore in college, mm-hmm. junior.
Later became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he called all the athletes to Cleveland, where his office was based. And basically, these athletes met with Muhammad Ali the night before. Because a lot of these guys, including Jim Brown, had been in the Army or in the Air Force. Mm-hmm. And finally, after a very... you know, sort of a very pointed conversation, they realized that this guy was standing on principle. They came the next day and they held a press conference, which is now, it's a famous picture of all the athletes. And they held a press conference saying that we support Muhammad Ali. Now, a lot of people point out that this was 67. A lot of those guys didn't have agents. Mm-hmm. No, they didn't have agents mm-hmm. back then.
Endorsements weren't as big a part of the picture then?
No part.
Yeah.
There's no part. And so that, to me, became my standard of what a black man was, a woman, or what a black athlete could do in this limelight, how you could use your podium, your stand, your arena, the way Ali did, the way Kurt Flood did, the way Smith and Carlos did, the way Jim Brown did. And I think that we went through this point of wilderness as the money started becoming so great mm-hmm. that I think a couple of generations, I think it culminated probably with Michael Jordan when—
In the 80s.
This
famous Republicans buy shoes to comment.
Yeah, whether he's made it or not. I mean, there's
some debate about whether he said this, but yeah.
But it's close enough.
Right.
Your actions speak louder than—
Well, the basic ethic that money was more important than any kind of political or social stand.
Right. And that set the tone, I think, for a couple of generations of black mm-hmm. guys. Well, hey, man, mm-hmm. if we just don't rock the boat, we can make it. But then you see, you know, and I think that's where we are now. So, you know, that's not a way to live. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, and just because you don't rock the boat doesn't mean they're not going to deal with you. What did Dick Gregory say? Just because you think somebody's after you doesn't mean you're not—
Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that nobody's after you. Right? So you've heard, as have I, the commentary from a number of different quarters that, athletes would just keep politics out of sports. And, you know, many conservatives have said this in particular. I don't know, what's your estimation of that, the likelihood of it? Is sports ever apolitical?
You know, Jelani, listen, man, as soon as you play the national anthem, you politicize the sport. As soon as you do that, I mean, I'm a jazz guy. You go to concerts, there's no national anthem, mm-hmm. you know, for a jazz Lincoln Center. There's no, you know, go mm-hmm. in, hit them, you sit down. As soon as you play the national anthem, you politicize it. That horse has left the barn a long time ago. I mean, going back to Jack Johnson, it's always been politicized. what people are saying. Also, it depends on what your politics are. If the politics suit you, then it's okay. You know, it's okay. But so I think that that conversation really is not, that's not to me a debatable issue. It's already, and also I think what it is that it's disturbing. What they're trying to say is that, you know, we don't want our hypocrisy to wash up on us.
Mm-hmm. What happens to Kaepernick? We've seen this before. This is even kind of maybe akin to that period where Ali was kind of in the wilderness in his career for refusing to go to Vietnam. How does this end for him?
I would love for it to end with him being on the roster, or at least getting an opportunity to play. But yeah, then you think about it, Jelani. What happened right now, you know, Colin has become this symbol. If his career, if he doesn't play another down, his name will probably go down, I don't know, for the next, you know, 20, 30, 40 years as somebody who's triggered this thing. Now, if he gets on a roster suddenly, and he throws 5 interceptions, yeah, that, you know, oh my God.
That becomes the story.
Now that's because, hey, that's why you're talking, you know. Mm-hmm. So you kind of lose this, you lose this veneer of kind of sainthood or martyrdom when you get on there and you throw 5 interceptions and he gets beat 55-0,
mm-hmm.
you know, as opposed to just staying on, you know, in becoming this figure.
Is it better for him to not come back?
I mean, cynically, what I just painted was a cynical thing about the backup quarterback is always the most popular person on the team until you kind of get signed. But I think as a show of good faith, for example, the owners are asking the players secretly now, what can we do? So, okay, first thing, sign Kaepernick. One of you SOBs, sign Kaepernick. Guarantee you, we'll all say, okay. Now, the issues that he raised will still be with us, but you as owners have made a statement, said, you know what? Maybe we did blackball this guy. It wasn't right. And we're going to bring him back and give him a shot.
So should we do away with playing the anthem altogether?
I think so. And I've thought so for a while. And by the way, anybody who's been to a football, basketball, baseball game, go to the corridors while during the national anthem. People are buying popcorn and beer. They're not standing for the national anthem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're doing everything.
Yeah.
You know, what do you do at home when you're watching the game? And people aren't, you know, so again, this is this sort of hypocrisy that we built a whole, five-week news cycle on.
Mm-hmm.
About the flag and the national anthem. Give me a break with this stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's probably not going to happen. But yeah, I think that they should just stop it. Just come in and play Grand Funk or something. Just, you know, play So What. You know, maybe make that.
So I do not think that people are going to replace the national anthem with Funkadelic.
It would
probably be the most interesting development. One Nation Under a Groove.
Right?
That might actually be unifying. That could be a unifying.
This is a new national anthem. You heard it here first.
Here's a chance to dance our way out of our constriction.
Bill Roden, a former New York Times columnist and a contributor to the ESPN website called The Undefeated. He spoke with staff writer Jelani Cobb. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Ready or not, here we come. Getting down on the one which we believe.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour, and I'm David Remnick. Not long ago, I spent the afternoon at a concert hall on the west side of Manhattan, where Annie Clark was getting ready for a show. Clark performs under the name St. Vincent, and she started out in indie rock. She played with artists like Sufjan Stevens. But St. Vincent was an old-school shredder, a terrific guitar player and a rock star. As a solo artist, she's been compared to David Bowie, and her music is heady and layered, and not always easy. but it's catchy and somehow seductive.
You trade.
St. Vincent's new album, just out, is called Mass Seduction. I asked her about the title track.
This is Toko Yasuda, who plays in my live band. I wanted her to pretend like she was an alien describing how to seduce someone, but in Japanese.
Black saints and a lady playing like a soul.
Why in Japanese?
Because a couple reasons. One, a totally self-serving one, which is that I love Japan and I want to be big in Japan so that I can go there all the time. I mean, I'm not above strategy.
Why did you decide to make this track the title track? In other words, how does it shape the whole of the album, the conception of the album, the themes of the album?
It's more or less kind of like a thesis. It's more or less, it contains all the characters that you meet on the album. I thought of it like a graduate thesis or something.
A graduate thesis?
Yeah.
Well, how would you summarize it? What is the thesis? Because the album is just coming out. How would you describe it?
I would say it's an exploration of power and the rosy sides of power, you know, and also the grim sides. I mean, the kinds of things that can have a total hold over you, be it, you know, drugs or sex or is it telling that those are the only two things I can think of? I know there's a third thing.
Sadness. I think you told Nick Baumgarten, yes, who wrote a profile of you in the magazine.
Yes.
Sex, drugs, and sadness. Now, has it been that kind of period for you in the last few years? It's been 3 years since you've had an album come out.
It was a wild 3 years. A lot of life happened in those 3 years, for sure.
I also read a Nick's essay about you that you said that you've been living through, while recording this album, which takes a lot longer than people would imagine,
yeah,
a life of kind of monastic aloneness, that your life was a Pilates class.
I love Pilates.
Maybe reading a book here and there.
Yeah.
And then work.
Yeah. I hit a point where I just needed everything but the most vital things for creativity to just go away.
Were you in trouble? Did you feel off balance?
Well, certainly off balance, yeah. Certainly off balance. I just needed to do sort of a radical reorganizing of my life, in order to fulfill. This sounds really like a Tolkien thing or something, but like in order to fulfill my destiny as a creative person, I needed to just clear a path.
Otherwise, what would happen?
You know, otherwise, just depression would take its jaws and just swallow me completely.
That's where you were.
That's what would happen. Yeah.
And that's a long-standing problem, or that was a problem of the moment?
Talking about anxiety and depression, it seems like I It doesn't seem like anything that's stigmatized to me anymore, because all of my friends are, you know, have dealt with it over their entire life. So I've been a really anxious person since I was a kid, and more or less I think that's helped me because I sought ways to cope with it creatively, and felt, you know, safe in being able to make something.
Pills to wake, pills to sleep, pills, pills, pills every day of the week. Pills to walk, pills to think, pills, pills, pills for the family. I spent a year suspended in air, my mind on the gap, my head on the stairs. From healer to dealers and then back again, from guru to voodoo and voodoo to zen. Pills to wake, pills to sleep, pills, pills, pills every day of the week.
And there's a song on the album where you... well, embrace and reject the pharmacological way of getting at it, pills.
Yeah.
Was that a struggle for you?
You know what? I don't want to overstate it because truly, as it pertains to, like, drugs, I'm kind of a Pollyanna. I never really, like, I still, like, I've only seen cocaine like 3 times in my life, which is so stupid. Like, you would think that it would just be, you know, be lying on people's naked bodies at parties, but that's just like not the vibe. So, yeah. So I don't want to overstate it, but I was in a period of my life where I was working so much that I didn't know how to get a hold of my life in any meaningful sort of centering kind of way. And yeah, I was certainly relying on more pills than I should have been taking to deal with anxiety and depression. But I'm not anti-antidepressant by any means or anything. Those kind of things have really helped me at certain times.
Now I have to ask you a musical question.
Yeah.
So I'm the kind of dork that watches, I'm making a big confession on national radio, guitar instruction stuff on YouTube. And as you know, there's gazillions of them. If you want to learn how to play something, some Norwegian kid will teach you how to do it. And it's embarrassing. All that stuff that as a kid you didn't know how to do, some kid teaches. I'm watching you with some guy whose name escapes me backstage at the Capitol Theater in Portchester. And he's asking you all kinds of dorky questions about playing the guitar. And yet the guitar seems to be getting stripped away. Conventional instrumentation seems to be less and less a part of your music. Sometimes you'll have a straight piano, but more and more it's electronic. Tell me about that conversion from being one of the great guitar players and shredders to somebody that's changing her sound, and why?
I will say there are definitely guitar moments on this album. It's not without guitar, but it's a funny thing. The guitar, I've been playing it so long. I've been playing it for over 20 years, which is weird because I'm 25. So no, I've been playing it for over 20 years. So it's so much a part of my person, you know. But there's a certain amount of guitar playing that is about pride that isn't about the song. And on this...
You mean macho speed and all that kind of thing?
Yeah. Yeah. It just didn't... That's not the way that I want to hear guitar, and it's not the way that I want to present it in my music.
How do you want to hear guitar? What do you mean?
I want it to be like a perverse tornado, or like I want it to be a lot of times really uncomfortable. I want it to be the one thing that comes in and disrupts the scene completely.
Well, you make these sounds on the guitar like nobody else. In other words, you're on that video I was watching, you're showing this guy who knows a fair amount. He said, "I'm playing a minor second," which creates a sound that feels like, you know, the floor is coming out under your feet. And then at one point you say to him, and here's a Debussy voicing, and I thought his face was going to fall.
My uncle taught me that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. How much is that is stuff that you learned in music school? You went to Berklee School of Music, and how much is just screwing around at home?
Man, do you ever feel like you have been coasting on the books you read in high school? Mm-hmm. Because that's the time when you are just the most absorbent. In some ways, I feel like I've been coasting on the things I learned when I kind of first started playing guitar, when I was watching my uncle play.
Who's, and your uncle, we should say, was a terrific guitar player.
Oh, yeah. Tuck Andress, he's one of the greats, one of the jazz finger style master. I mean, it's unbelievable. I forgot your question. Is what happened.
In other words, what the sounds that you want to make on guitar are to match your emotional life, not to impress anybody.
Yeah, I think I'm not that interested in guitar being a means of poorly covered up pride.
You said something interesting about this song, New York, which we want to play.
New York isn't New York without you, love. So far in a few blocks to be so low. And if I call you from First Avenue, we're the only in the city who can handle me. New love wasn't true love, back to you, love. So much for a home run with some blue blood. If I stand me, I have lost a hero, I have lost a friend, but for you, darling, I'd do it all again.
You said that it's the first song where you thought this might be someone's favorite song. What do you mean by that?
Some songs are hard labor, and I mean every word, every note is just like deeply labored over until it finally gets to the right spot. And
so these things take a long time.
Sometimes, yeah, super hard. And then some songs feel like they're floating around in the ether and they could have gone to your next door neighbor. But like you were the lucky recipient of them somehow. And New York was one of those songs, the melody and everything, it kind of came rather quickly. And it was one of those songs that it felt like I just sort of pulled out of the ether more or less fully formed and was like, thank you. Thanks for that.
In your own life, have you ever had records or books or any work of art that changed you in an apparent way, politically?
Deeply.
I mean. For example?
Black Like Me. I read that when I was 13.
Right, which is a school that was a book that was often assigned in school.
This
about
was not right, assigned in school.
Oh, you were on the outside. It was somebody who gets his skin darkened and mm-hmm. tries to enter the experience of an African-American man.
Yes, and he does, and he's brutalized. And that, something like that, all of these things are empathy exercises. And at its best, that's what art is. And I really, really, really firmly believe, and I wouldn't be doing what I do if I didn't, that art, music, theater, film, I believe that those things change people's minds and make them more human and remind them of their humanity and thus the humanity of others.
So I was really, really young, really young, and heard I Want You, Bob Dylan, long before I knew what it was to want you. Mm-hmm. But it took the top of my head off somehow. I mean, I was really young, 7 years old or something like mm-hmm. that. And you were a similar age and were listening to Nevermind, the Nirvana album, at home. What did it do to you that young? How does art penetrate somebody 8, 9 years old?
I mean, children have, they might not have the lexicon to describe the emotions that they feel and the things they're intuiting, but they have all of the same emotions just in this tiny body. And I had a lot of the anxiety emotion. I had a lot of fear. And so hearing the kind of purge of that fear through Kurt Cobain and Nevermind and was liberating. It said to me, you're not alone. It said to me, we're all in this. Like, you have a tribe, is what it said to me.
And you could hear that at 8 or 9.
Absolutely. I'm sorry. Yeah. Sorry. Absolutely. You go, okay, I'm not alone in this.
It must have been an incredible experience for you to stand up, you as Kurt Cobain for Nirvana, and sing in front of that band. And this was at the induction ceremony for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Brooklyn.
I'm so happy because today I found my friends. They're in my head. I'm so ugly. That's okay, cause so are you. We broke our mirrors Sunday morning. It's every day for all I care. And I'm not scared. Light my candles in the days, cause I found God.
Can you describe that experience?
You know, David, I kind of can't. I don't know. That's one that I don't know. I don't know where to put that experience. Because everyone wishes that Kurt was there doing that. And I wish that too. So I don't know where to put that experience. It feels very strange to be joyful about it.
What were you feeling up on stage when you were singing?
Something like transcendence. Something like it.
How often does that happen on stage? You tour and you play night after night, and set lists are, I assume, they alter, but they're pretty much the same. You're playing a show. It's called show business. How often is it transcendent, and how often does it feel like a night at work?
There's something in the structure and building a really solid structure and foundation and architecture of a show that to me feels safe. And what I mean by safe is
What is safe?
What I mean by safe is that it means that I know that the show is always going to be at a certain level of quality because I've beta tested it, you know, extensively. And then so that I have this platform on top of that, just like baseline level of quality, to experiment with exactly how emotional it can be. And the thing about it is that performing night after night, it's a little bit like being an actor in that you need to be able to say your lines. You need to remember them. You need to stand in your light. You need to be, you know, have all the blocking down. Because at that point, it's not about you and it's not about your experience in a lot of ways. It's about the audience's experience. So sometimes I'm so in it and I'm reliving every moment of the heartbreak of the song and singing that. And then sometimes I am totally disassociated, but I don't think...
You're outside your own body.
It's hard to explain. It's, you know, it's not, unfortunately, that, like, you know, ghost floating above the bed looking down. It's not that, but sometimes it is just this sort of, I went from this dot to that dot to that dot, and we did the show.
I've just heard that you're going to direct a film version of The Picture of Dorian Gray, Oscar Wilde's great novel. How did that come about? Why'd you decide to do this? And it's not what I expected, but I know to expect the unexpected.
Well, a couple years ago, I was asked to be a part of an all-female horror anthology called The XX. And my ethos in life is to do things that are scary. And, you know, luckily for me, most things are scary. So I do a lot of things. So I did this horror short, even though I don't like horror movies. Mine was more of a black comedy. It starred Melanie Lynskey, who was amazing. And
what was the plot?
Oh, boy. I keep describing it as Weekend at Bernie's 2 meets Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. It's like, oh, it's so stupid. A mother wakes up on the day that she is throwing her child a 7th birthday, and she finds her husband dead of an overdose of some kind. And we don't know if it's suicide or an overdose. And she decides that hell or high water, she's going to give her daughter a good birthday, no matter what. So she's sort of frazzled, Elizabeth Taylor hairstyled woman. And she hides the body and eventually hides the body in a big bear suit and puts it at the front of the table as all the kids are, you know, coming in, and they're about to blow out the candles at the cake. And he accidentally gets nudged by the nanny who's bringing in the cake, and then his face falls into the cake, and then the nanny takes the hood off and it reveals it's the dead dad. And then the kids scream and it's over.
Yeah. Now, with the Oscar Wilde thing, you're going to keep it pretty much on the Oscar Wilde plot, or you're going to take it into...
It's okay. So Harland. That was the entire plot of The Birthday Party. see it now. It's on Netflix. But the Oscar Wilde thing, yeah, I was approached by Lionsgate about being involved in an adaptation of Dorian Gray, but this time with a female protagonist and set in more or less modern times. And I said, yes, I'm very interested in doing that, but only if I can work with David Burke, who wrote Elle, mm-hmm. which is the French film, Paul Verhoeven and Isabelle Huppert. Elle is the best thing I've ever seen. I'm totally obsessed with Elle. And so I contacted David.
That movie is scary as hell.
It's hilarious to me. To be discussed after
that movie, boy.
Oh my god!
Yeah. So we're at the Highline Studios, which is an events performance place, and you're the evening that we're meeting during the afternoon. You're going to be singing for an event. What are you going to play?
Well, I'm going to play "All You Need Is Love," the Beatles classic. I'm going to play "New York," and I'm going to. I basically picked the saddest songs in my repertoire, of which there are many, but I picked the absolute most bleak for this party tonight. Glamorously sad songs.
Perfect. Perfect. On another occasion, you're going to show me how to play I Dig a Pony.
Yeah, if I can remember it.
You don't do covers that often.
No, because I don't know how to play anyone else's songs.
I don't believe you.
No, it's true.
I dig a pony. You can celebrate anything you want. Yes, we can celebrate anything we want.
Annie Clark, also known as Saint Vincent. Her album Mass Seduction is just out. Coming up, one of those awkward conversations with your mom this time about Playboy. Stick around.
Just like you want it to.
I'm David Remnick. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. The death last month of Hugh Hefner reopened a debate about the Playboy founder and the world he created. When pornography was still a kind of secretive enterprise, Hefner put naked and near-naked women in full color right into the respectable households of America. Hefner thought he was an instigator of the sexual revolution, and he was making a great blow against Puritanism.
It's an attempt to replace the old legalism. It's certainly not a rejection of monogamy as such, but very much an attempt, in the case of premarital sex, there really hasn't been any moral code in the past except simply a thou shalt not. And
well, that's a code, isn't it?
Well, perhaps. I don't think it's a very realistic one.
Not everyone saw it in such high-minded terms. Some thought women were being exploited, and that divide is still present in how people think about Playboy's legacy. Janice Moses was just 19 when she took a job in the photography department at Playboy, and she rose through the ranks to become a photo editor. Janice left Playboy before her daughter Michelle was born and didn't really talk with her much about the experience. Michelle followed her mother into the magazine business, although she works here at The New Yorker, where you don't get all that much nudity.
When you were 19 and you entered that environment for the first time, like, had you ever seen pictures of naked women before entering into that environment?
You know, it's interesting. That was one of Vince's questions during our interview. You know, have you ever been around nude models before? And quite honestly, I so badly needed a job that, of course, I had to tell a lie and say, yeah, oh, yeah, I've been around nude models before in art class. But truly, I hadn't. And, you know, at that time, Playboy was a much broader-based magazine. So it's not like there were naked ladies running around the studio all day.
And actually, I would love to hear a bit more about your personal interactions with Hefner. I know that when you became a photo editor, you were presenting your work to him on a very regular basis. What was he like to interact with?
He was intimidating. For sure. In fact, thankfully, I found these few pictures of what it was like to meet with him. And that's me sitting right
now.
All right.
So what's going on? There's a picture that I'm looking at. My mom is a blonde bombshell.
Look how we're looking at each other.
Mm-hmm. And he's holding his pipe in hand, wearing a silk pajama shirt.
Always.
And they have the mock-up of the magazine in front of them, it looks like.
Yeah, that was, you know, what we called, I think we called it the Blue Book or the Black Book or something. It was a pasted-up book. That's how magazines were done in those days.
Oh, we have one?
The Brown Book. It was a pasted-up version of the book. And, you know, we went over it page by page, line by line, picture by picture. And when you think about how he was so involved in every detail, and for him, money was no object. It was all about perfection, whether it was re-editing the copy or reshooting the pictures, to the sometimes the great frustration of some of the people that worked for him, because he was very challenging and he had his view of perfection of everything.
Like, did you all feel like there was a mission that Playboy was on that you were a part of? Can you tell me, like, how that felt from the inside?
You take me back to a memory of a photo shoot that we did very early in my career. And we were on the campuses of, you know, the top five colleges, or what we thought were the top five colleges. And so we went to Antioch in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And we got there, and the kids were so upset. And a group of them literally stole the boxes of clothing that we had shipped from the fashion department to put on the models. And they said, we want to confront you, and we want to have a conversation with you. So they sat us down in a room in their student union. And these were the earliest days of demonstrations on campus. And so these kids, the boys, did a nude-in demonstration, and clusters of boys came through the windows running naked across this this panel. Of course, I was terrified for my life. I wanted to get out of there. And
did you understand their objections to Playboy? Did you understand what their grievances were?
Well, they thought we were the establishment.
But not to simplify it.
I don't want to simplify it, but for me, I must confess, I could only scratch my head because I was on the inside where I had so much freedom to do and be and work and express myself that I was like, what's so conservative about us? What are they seeing? I'm just here.
Did you hear from the students? Did they describe to you or did they give you a good sense of what they were objecting to?
As we walked out of that student union, this young college girl came up next to me, and we were very close in age at the time, actually. And, you know, there she was, braless, in her little kind of hippie top, and being oh so bold. And, you know, she just was, she was upset because she thought we were taking advantage of women. And yet she was standing there braless and free to be who she was because we gave women the freedom to do that. So it was confusing for me.
Mm-hmm. Did you, it's, you know, that's a great story. She's like your foil. She's like the life you could have led in some ways.
Yeah.
Did you feel any envy
but
for
you
her
see me
to be so bold?
Of course I did. Here I am in my quilted top because let's describe this picture. I'm in a quilted tapestry jacket. Mm-hmm. You know, God forbid anybody should see me braless.
Is that how you felt in the office? God forbid anyone should see me braless.
No, I have pictures here.
Well, no, you don't need to show them. But I mean, like, how did you feel about your own body in that setting, where women's bodies were the centerpiece?
Well, you know, let's go back to why women.
Did you get a lot of sexual attention?
Let's go back to why women burned their bras at that moment. Mm-hmm. It was Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan who came on the scene and made us powerful. And I was not attracted to what the girls in the secretarial pool wanted to do and wanted to talk about. I wanted to go out and be with the guys and test the film and search for the light and, you know, help set up the productions. And it was all there for me. They were like, sure, show up. Anything you want to do. Here, take this, do that. Be responsible for that. And, you know, by 21, I had a lot of responsibility. By 23, I was running the photo studio. By then, we had 6 staff photographers, 5 staff stylists, painters, carpenters, electricians, and I was running this whole little section of the business of the photo studio, the logistics, the production, the set building. You know, it was it fell on my desk at a very young age because I felt this freedom to be able to do these things.
If you imagined your career, if you imagine it happening again and you had that much responsibility and that much freedom at a place that wasn't Playboy, that didn't have the same social or political mission or influence, do you think that would have changed the whole thing for you? Do you think that it could have been a religion somewhere else, or was there something really Playboy specific for you that made it what you believed in, that made it what you wanted to work for?
That's a difficult one to answer simply. You know, I landed this job as a kid and just stayed. And you know, I've told you there were times long before I left that I was very unhappy there, that I didn't like what the magazine was about. I didn't think some of it was funny. I didn't endorse it philosophically. I didn't want to see it on the pages. I didn't want to ask, you know, for people to do the things I was asking them to do.
What kinds of things made you uneasy?
I didn't like seeing 2 girls together in a sexual context.
Well, that's
that's me. That's my opinion.
I don't like that answer.
Yeah. Well, I didn't. I mean, you know, that's just right. You know,
that sounds kind of homophobic, Mom.
Well, Interesting. I didn't think of it as homophobic at that point. I thought of it as for the entertainment of the viewer.
The entertainment of the male viewer?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that's what you were starting to notice.
Yeah. That's what bothered me. That was when it all came together at the same moment when it was Playboy and Penthouse and Hustler trying to compete for attention and sales. And so we wanted to push the envelope on, you know, how explicit or how suggestive. And it just went to a place that I wasn't comfortable with. And that's when I became unhappy with being there and doing this work. And so then I would just focus on what my job was. You know, when you're unhappy in a job, you don't leave the next day. You have to let it wear at you for a very long time until one day you go, I need out. I can't live my life. I remember the day that the guy in the next office got a raise, and he was a guy, and he got more than me, and we did the same job. I did more than he did, I thought. I'd produced 7 centerfolds that year, and he'd produced some pictorials. And I never thought that was fair. So for me, my rights as a woman were always very important. And it turned out to be the very best decision. I have you. I have my own wonderful business. And it's all good.
And, you know, I was remembering, when I was 6 years old and Britney Spears came out with the album Hit Me Baby One More Time. I remember wanting it so badly, asking for it, and you got me the CD, but I know that you were sort of uncomfortable with the way she presented herself in this, like, skimpy schoolgirl outfit for an audience of young people. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about where maybe that sense of discomfort came from for the kind of media that I was consuming and how it differed from what you thought about the work that you did then.
This has more to do with me as a woman than me as an employee of Playboy.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with the me inspired by Gloria Steinem. And I felt, not Britney Spears particularly, but there was a moment in time around that time when there was a...
In my childhood.
In your childhood, when there was a bevy of female singers who came on the scene in very provocative clothing. There's another one who was competing.
Christina Aguilera.
Thank you. Beyond provocative. Who I thought were taking us, we women, backwards. So the way we dressed the women in the magazine was not the way we walked around the office. Okay? There were no nude women walking around the office. In fact, there was actually nobody walking around in low-cut dresses with cleavage. Everybody was pretty buttoned up. In fact, if I pulled out enough pictures, you would see how really buttoned up everybody was. But I just felt that at the time of the Christina Britney era, there was a shift in female behavior in the everyday world and offices and just on the street that I didn't think was going to forward them getting more respect and equal pay for the work that they did or have a voice that was going to be rewarded or be heard or be respected.
So what was shown in the pages of the magazine entered into our everyday world and inspired the behavior of people outside of the realm of entertainment.
This is true.
It's been really special for me to hear these stories I've never heard before, so I'm really glad we did this.
Thank you so much.
Janice Moses, in conversation with her daughter, Michelle. Janice managed the photography studio at Playboy and was a photography editor. Michelle is on the editorial staff of The New Yorker. That's it for today's show. I'm David Remnick, and next week, we'll hear an interview with Chelsea Manning, the former intelligence analyst who served 7 years in prison after sending a huge haul of military and diplomatic cables to WikiLeaks. I hope you'll join us for that. Until then, have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrato.
This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Rayfield, Mythali Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Sarah Sandbach, Jessica Henderson, and Terrence Bernardo. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.